You're listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Join us for weekly discussions diving into all the particulars of communication, voice, swallow, and cognition with tangible applications to the world of medical speech and language pathology. Resources and the discussion guide are located in the specially curated show notes on speechuncensored.com. Rachel Archambault joins me this week to talk about trauma-informed care. Rachel shares how she got into this topic as an SLP and how the main principles of TIC, trustworthiness, safety, empowerment, choice, and collaboration, can be applied to the medical speech setting. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your intrigued host, and I hope you're ready to get your nourish and flourish on. Welcome to the podcast, Rachel. I'm so excited to have you today. This is going to be a really interesting topic. As we were discussing earlier before coming on, I really haven't been exposed to the concept of trauma-informed care in my practice yet. So yeah, I'm really excited for this. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. All right, Rachel, tell me a little bit more about you, who you are, where are you, and what you do.
So my name is Rachel Archambault. I am in my fifth year at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. I also work part-time at a private practice, I think for the last 4 years, and that's kids from birth to, I think the oldest I treated was 30. I also have tried out recently a skilled nursing facility, and I did home health my first year. So I've just kind of been trying every setting possible post-grad school. I graduated from UCF for both undergrad and grad school, University of Central Florida, and I'm in Fort Lauderdale right now.
All right, very nice. Well, it's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, let's get started. So let's actually start off with like kind of the definition of what is trauma-informed care, which in different settings might also be called trauma-informed education.
Right. So I pulled up a definition of trauma-informed education includes examining the influence and impact on students in our schools of factors such as racism, poverty, peer victimization, community violence, and bullying. So anything that can be considered trauma, a traumatic event. I like to view my clients or my students as that they have experienced trauma, some sort of trauma in their life. And it's a way of me speaking to them, me being mindful of me as their caretaker, support person at school or private practice, not doing anything to accidentally trigger someone. I'm very deliberate with what I say. And I actually adjust what I say based on what is known, but you're not always going to know what trauma you're going through. So I assume everyone has gone through trauma, not just the students that I know at my school that have experienced trauma, but even the ones pre that traumatic event, they might have experienced trauma. And I treat in my personal life too. I constantly am evaluating people's behaviors like, oh, that they're probably having a really bad day. I give people the benefit of the doubt all the time.
I think that's really key. And that's like something I've had to learn through trial and error, just like in my own personal life of interacting with other people, like outside of work. It's just giving people the benefit of the doubt. Like, we don't know what they've been going through. And if someone is really short with us or really abrupt, I think we tend to like take it personal.
Yeah.
Like, why are they being mad at me? Like, what did I do?
Yeah.
When really, I think we should be asking ourselves, like, what's going on with them? Like, what are they handling and dealing with that's so overwhelming that they like are, in a sense, like lashing out like this?
Absolutely. And I see all the time on like medical page meme pages that you always experience the angry nurse or something like that. And instead of just labeling someone, like I'm not in that mindset anymore. I've completely changed how I view my interactions with other people. So it's kind of like, oh, well, maybe they are so like compassion fatigue. They don't have the ability to just care or like cry about patients. And you think that people are cold, and it's not like that. It's just that they've experienced, especially now during pandemic and COVID times, people are emotionally checked out. And that's a way to protect themselves from all the pain. And I do this with everyone I encounter. So it's really important to use this in your professional life, because it saves you from a lot of the heartbreak when you think you're the only one that cares about anything You're like, no, these people care just as much, but they might be going through something else. You also need to apply it to your patients, their caregivers, people like that. What's wrong with these people doesn't always fit, you know? It might not just be they're acting mean today. Mm-hmm. It might be something deeper that you don't know about.
Yeah. All right. Like, I feel like the more we're going to unpack this concept, I'm going to be like, why has this not been at the forefront of my education? And I don't want to like give shade to anything because there's so much we have to pass on in education, but also just in my practice, like in the hospital system, because everyone who comes into the hospital has had some form of trauma. You know, and it's not just, oh, they were in a motor vehicle crash. Like clearly, oh, that's obviously trauma. No, like when someone has a stroke, that's a traumatic event that significantly impacts them on so many different levels.
And me, since starting this whole journey with my page, which I'll explain about, there were things that I didn't really understand could be labeled as trauma. Like I'm 28, I'm single, I do not have kids. I didn't know that there's a whole world out there of birth trauma. Like things that happen to you in the birthing procedure, you know, that things can be very traumatic. There's support groups for it online. I had no idea because I personally haven't experienced it. And I think that's the mindset that people need to go in. Just because it hasn't happened to you doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And a lot of people talk about car accidents all the time, how it's not traumatic unless you see it on the news, you know, this terrible, terrible accident. But even just minor car accidents can make you develop PTSD. Every time you get in the car, you start sweating. So it's not for you to say things are not traumatic to other people. A traumatic event is traumatic to that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a lot to process, but just having your mind open to that kind of stuff is really important.
Good, good. I'm looking forward to kind of unpacking that and seeing how you apply it in certain circumstances. But I want to take us into your next bullet point. So how did you get into trauma-informed care? Let's go ahead and lay down that backstory.
Okay, so trauma-informed care was something I sought out because in 2018 on Valentine's Day, so 2/14/18, I was in my second year as the speech pathologist at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, which for those of you that don't know, that's in Parkland, Florida, and it had the mass shooting. 17 people died, including 3 adults and 14 students, and then 17 others were also injured. So I was there that day, and trauma-informed care for me came out because of what happened after. Not necessarily that event, but it's what happened after, because we had to go back to school. And being in a school, you're going back to the scene of the crime every day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're seeing things that remind you for, I mean, we still, this is, February was 3 years since it happened, but the students this year that are seniors were freshmen that year. Mm-hmm. So they are still, and so are the staff, very triggered by fire alarms. So we don't do fire alarm drills. We do silent ones. So the principal will come over the intercom and say, hey guys, we're doing our monthly fire drill. Please talk to your teachers and we will exit the building as soon as I come back on the intercom. So that's a way to minimize the level of trauma. But we were having issues with, we can't control when it goes off. You know, sometimes the kids vaping in the bathroom or just like some technical glitch that we had that for a while. I think like 2 years ago, we had the alarm going off the first week of school constantly to the point that students stopped coming to school. That they're like, I can't handle this, that it's just going to go off. You had students running to whoever their safe person was on campus, but we try to minimize the risks as much as possible. So in that respect, it's very controlled at my school because we know what everyone's trauma is. We don't know all the traumas that they've gone through, but we know one that is common throughout everyone there. So I think that's really important. But I fell into trauma-informed education because when I came back, and we're supposed to be going back to our normal speech schedule, I had kids come in that just mentally weren't able to focus on it. I wasn't able to focus on it. And we had to come to some ground. How do we continue here? How do we make progress? But also, how do I put their mental health first? How do I put my mental health first? Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that I found trauma-informed education. It was a way of me speaking to them that giving them coping strategies or going through coping strategies, especially with my kids that are in speech or language therapy. They have trouble understanding like the comprehension of an article. So we did for a while, let's do breathing exercises and following directions in that way. So I would model it, I would do it visually. And I made that part of like the speech goal kind of. Mm-hmm. It was a way to talk to them. I give them space. I have a calm corner in my high school room that it's a dark corner. It's got a little like furry fluffy chair. It's got an essential oil bottle if they want that they can smell. They can sit there 5 minutes. If they want to just sit there and not talk to me before we start, they know at the end of the 5 minutes, they have to come back and we get started. So it's a way of treating them. I mean, I'm with high schoolers, so there's a level of understanding there. I don't have to chase them around the classroom and everything. But this is something that is easy to implement once you understand that it helps everyone. By treating everyone as though they have experienced some sort of trauma, you are able to better treat everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I think you're in a really unique situation to be able to experience like a very large like group trauma that's really shared through a large population and how your school has managed that on the whole. But then you also recognize that like these students probably were carrying around individual traumas before and they've acquired one since then, since that's just kind of also a part of being alive.
Yeah.
So like managing that and understanding that I think is really helpful. And so really, I hope it doesn't like water it down by being like, everyone has kind of.
Yes.
No, not kind of. Everyone has experienced different levels of trauma. That's very real to that person. Like you mentioned before, we can't make value judgments on the grade, the severity of their trauma based on our perspective. It's what matters to that person.
But we had that a lot, especially at my school, that you had people that I read every piece of news that came out, which was hundreds and hundreds of articles, opinion articles, and just posts online. I couldn't help myself from reading it at that time. And you had people that would comment on a post, and 2 weeks after it happened, there would be like, all right, guys, it's time to move on. Just get back to normal. And you're telling 14-year-olds, you're telling students to get over it. You're telling teachers to get over it. And they haven't experienced it. And I know that grief is not like up, you know, it's up and down. So you can't just tell people to get over it. That wasn't a constructive way of coping with this. So that was really tough. And a lot of students felt that on top of it, that their parents were even telling them, all right, let's go back to normal. It's been too long of you moping around the house or not being able to go to school, like get over it already. And that's not helpful for anyone. So my position behind this of trauma-informed schools is we also need to have this in the medical setting for speech. We need to have this in private practices. We need to have it for ourselves in the way that we talk with people. And like one example at the school, we have a TV teacher, right? And he teaches journalism, TV journalism kind of. And he stopped saying, go shoot a this. Like go shoot a segment on the garden outside. He stopped saying the word shoot because it was that like triggering for him as the teacher, but also for the students that it was like, maybe there's a better way that I could say this right now, that it's too heavy right now. Let me replace it. So he would just change his vocabulary that easy. It's not a big thing that he had to change his entire lesson plan around it. It was just a word. And that's what I do at a small level, that I change the words that I do. I just actually made a post about this recently about I have TikTok and I see that Gen Z is always talking about, like, they use hyperbole of death a lot. It's like, oh, I want to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And my generation, millennials, used to say that a lot, like, oh, I just want to kill myself. I have made a commitment to stop saying words about death. So even though they're so popular right now, even like the emoji debate that's happening is millennials would use the crying, laughing emoji to mean that's so funny. Gen Z uses a skeleton, like a skull head, to mean I'm dead. So, mm-hmm. and they even say it, I'm dead. You won't hear that at our school. They students don't want to talk about death anymore. So it's interesting that that has happened at our school, but you don't notice it until you have experienced something. And I want to get ahead of that. I want you to be aware of what you're saying, that, ooh, that's kind of cringy. We don't know what company we're in right now. Maybe someone just lost their parent due to COVID. Maybe someone lost someone for some reason. So I want to get ahead of it by just making the choices of my language more direct. Mm-hmm. And less graphic.
Yeah.
Less graphic.
That does. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I see where I'll be more observant of the type of language that I'm using around people, just to be sensitive to like where they're at. I think there's a continuum here, right? Because I know when I work with adults who have experienced something like a stroke and a change in their function, they become very sensitive to dignity issues, right? And so we don't want to change the way we're speaking to them to be like, oh, I know you've gone through something really tough. You know, no, you're still treating them like a person, like a human. You're just recognizing that they're also battling these other things that they're processing.
Right.
So I can see where we don't want people to kind of go way too overboard with like processing this and to be like, well, I can never talk about something that's happened in my life, like my own grandmother passing and they're facing like their own mortality. Like I won't be able to talk about that. It's also very situational, right? Like you have to build a relationship with somebody first. Yes. When you walk in a room, don't just start dropping things on people.
Right. And even speaking of dropping things, we had, I think it was the first year after the freshman that came in after that happened, we had a lot of kids that would drop books purposefully to scare people. We had to tell people, like, you can't really do that. You can't do that here. You shouldn't do that here. That's why. But they thought it was funny that the seniors, these big football players, would be scared. And we are, Yeah, it's terrible. And I don't think that's the case anymore. I think they've grown up. But I am concerned when next year comes and none of those students were here at that time. What's going to happen to the culture of the school that it's just wiped, you know? That they no longer, I'm not saying like walking on eggshells, because I think that has a negative connotation, but they're not trauma informed. If they were trauma informed, they wouldn't be acting that way. Mm-hmm. Even I know in other, when I was in high school, pulling the fire alarm was common. Now, I mean, you can get in trouble. I think you can get like arrested for false, you know, pulling the fire alarm and it's not actually a fire. That hasn't happened at our school. It's really been like technical glitches and stuff. But there are things that at our school that are put in place because the students experience trauma. And I'm concerned that when they leave, those same things they put in place might go away just because the staff is still there. I don't know if they care as much about the staff. It's all about the students. The parents are fighting for the students. But I'm scared that the staff will not be taken into account at that point. So I know a lot of the staff is worried about that, but I hope that they continue to be trauma-informed for us and make sure that we feel safe where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction to make. And I can see that can apply to the medical setting. You know, through the pandemic, people have had very different experiences and they can be carrying a lot of weight from that. And, you know, as we've gotten the vaccines, as our communities are kind of opening back up and we're starting to see like the other side of this pandemic, like we can't really ignore like the effect that it's had on the medical care staff.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, there's medical trauma. Like I was talking about the birth trauma, that's a part of medical trauma, but you also have the medical providers. The providers are the ones that are experiencing trauma right now, like we've never seen. I see posts all the time of healthcare workers that are just like, I'm on my 16th day of ICU with COVID and I don't feel anything anymore. I'm just tired. And I think this is going to continue going for a while now. Even the college students right now, I know I keep in touch with a lot of my students, especially from those couple of years. They didn't get spring break this year. They instead, the colleges were saying, here's a mental health day on a Thursday. But the professors still made their assignments due at whatever time. So just on Thursday, what ended up happening is the students just spent all their time working on assignments. There was no break for them. So that's not necessarily trauma-informed. Like, they still need a mental break. So it's really tough. I know trauma-informed care goes off 5 principles, which are safety, choice, collaboration, trustworthiness, and empowerment. And I think choice is a big one for us as medical providers, that we give our patients, especially the older ones, with dignity, right? We want to make sure that we give them, what do you want to do today? We give them the 2 choices. Do you want to do this activity or this activity? And even giving them the choice, do you not want to work with us today? That's an option. That's important. So I would give that to my students as well, that what are we going to do today? Are we going to work on our reading comprehension? Are we going to work on our S sounds? Or do you need a 5-minute break? What would you like to do right now? It's all about choice. And they feel safe in my room. I have made a room that I have not declared it a safe room. They have. If they declare it a safe room, then I'm comfortable in knowing that they will seek out my room in a moment of need where they can use their coping strategies and I can be a safe person to them. But I will never go around saying, I'm a safe person, whoever wants to be with me. Like, it doesn't work that way. They have to decide that you are safe or that room is safe. You have to collaborate with each other. If I see a coworker that says something that I know is triggering to a student or to a staff member, to another staff member, I say, hey, look, I don't disclose what I know, but I can say, hey, I know that that word might not work for that person. How about using this? Or this is what I use, and I get a really good response. It's all about how you say it to people.
Mm-hmm.
And empowerment. I want to give, especially with the coping skills, I want to give my students a range of coping skills that we go over and we learn them together. If they say this one doesn't work for me, fine, we'll go on to the next one. But empowerment in that if they're out in the real world and I'm not there, they don't need to call me and say, how do we work through our diaphragmatic breathing? They know how to do it and they can help themselves because I'm not going to be there in college with them. I'm not going to be there in trade school. I'm not going to be there at their job to help them through this. So we really have a safe school right now that gives them time to develop these skills, but they should have been given to them before. So I'm a big advocate of giving this training to like elementary schools. And it is very big right now in the schools of mindfulness, like schools have mindfulness stuff in the morning, but also just giving them those coping strategies, giving them the ability to express themselves at a young age and what they need is so important because when a crisis does occur, you don't need to work your way backwards. That was part of the hardest thing, that we had to work our way backwards, that they were at rock bottom and we had to build them up. And it's the same thing with, I tell everyone, get a therapist before stuff hits the fan. You know, like it's not helpful. And I did not do that. I had been to therapy when I was in school in Orlando. But when I came down here, I didn't have anyone available. And it wasn't until like 2 weeks after the shooting, what I went through, that I went to my therapist's office and just cried. And it was like the therapist's job to now decipher what happened before, what is from this, and what can I do to treat. It would have been so much better if I had someone who knew my situation before or knew my processing ability before to see a difference.
I really like how you pointed out about like kindly offering suggestions to people who might be using language that isn't appropriate, like would trigger somebody. I remember like years and years and years ago, I was volunteering at a daycare and I like made some comment on the playground to one of the kids and one of their teachers was standing nearby and she corrected me on like, let's not say that to this particular kid. Like that's not going to work out, you know, for that kid. And rather than just feel like embarrassed or angry about my faux pas, because it was unknown and unintentional, I was really, really happy and pleased that she reached out and let me know.
Yes.
Because when we walk through this world, we don't want to harm people, especially like unintentionally, you know? And so she knew more about that kid and could provide that insight to me in a way so that I wouldn't make those same mistakes or further complicate like what they were going
Absolutely.
Through.
Absolutely. And I went to an amazing session at ASHA in 2019 that was trauma-informed, and it was by a psychologist or psychiatrist. She was an amazing presenter. If she goes again, like that would be amazing for people to attend. But she was talking about, she works with children 0 to 5 that have experienced massive trauma, like documented trauma. And she said that at one session, a child that she had never met before, who was like 2 or 3, came into the room. And she's telling the story to all of us in the room. This child came in and immediately started having dysregulation, getting upset, and nothing had been done, just walked into the room and had a meltdown. And the person that was with the child said, "You're wearing a bun just like this child's abuser." So it's, you can't predict every trauma or trigger. It's impossible. But what that woman can do is every time she sees this student in the future, child in the future, is make sure she's not wearing her hair that way. She can, there's tons of ways you can do your hair. Make sure on that day to not do that. And you know what I started doing at the school? We had so many companies donating shirts, swag of everything. It said MSD Strong across everything. And some, at one point I had like 20 bracelets that were just, I would switch them out every day. I started realizing at the year point that people stopped wearing it, that it was like enough already. Like we just want to go about our normal day. So I stopped wearing shirts. And very soon after, there was someone that made a shirt that had all the names of the deceased on the back. I never wore that shirt because I didn't want to be walking in front of a student in the hallway that sees their best friend's name on my back. And it was an unnecessary trigger. So although these things were made in good, with good intentions, it was something that I had to learn there and see that how could what I'm doing, not meant to harm anyone, do harm. And that's when I change it. And, you know, I've had some people that reach out to me on my Instagram and they say, like, aren't you worried? Like, we can't just treat people as like snowflakes or, you know, and I don't see it that way. I don't see this as like I'm going above and beyond to make it so no one is ever hurt. I love dark humor. I love some of that stuff that really... when it's true, I like that. But I'm not gonna go to my workplace where so many people are affected, even in that community. I do not wear any shirts that say MSD Strong on it because it's more triggering now. It's not so much a support thing. Before, in the beginning, it was a thing of support, like we can do this. But as time went on, it's just changed. And I don't know how to explain why. But that's what the culture of the school has been, of the community has been. So I will respect that and not wear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like how you said it's not going above and beyond, but it's being respectful and in tune to what's happening around you. In other words, you're reading the room.
Yes.
You know, we have that statement, read the room, yeah. Like know what's going on around you before you stick your foot in your mouth. So that's just human behavior. That's how we need to proceed through the world. And this is just recognizing that you don't know what's going on in the room. But as soon as you do know, you can be respectful of that situation.
Right. Exactly. It comes down to respect. I respect my students. I don't demand respect from them. I earn their respect. I have to show them that I'm trustworthy. I have to show them that I care about them. And that's what I try to do every day. And if it's little things like word changes, I already change my vocabulary when I'm at school. I curse a lot outside of school, but when I'm at school, I don't go around like cursing, you know? So it's not like it's unheard of to change your language. Parents do that all the time with their children, that they change to a language that's more in tune for their 2-year-old. So it's not something that's unheard of. This is something that is totally doable, and it ends up making better relationships between people, and it's more productive. My speech sessions had never been better after that we created a bond that wasn't over the top. And that's another thing that I want to talk about, is that there's this emergence at the schools, the school level, that trauma-informed education is the hot topic right now. And what's happening is there's a lot of research out there, especially about ACEs. I don't know if you've heard what ACEs are. It's adverse childhood experiences. And there's a very, I mean, I love this TED Talk. It's by a woman called Nadine Burke-Harris, and she is the current Surgeon General of California. She's the first Surgeon General of California. And she's a pediatrician, and she gave a talk about ACEs that she was in a study that talked about this. It's a paper that's a screener for physicians to give children. If you have this many traumatic events, you are more likely to have a reduced lifespan. If you have this many, you are 30 times more likely to have a heart attack or something. That one I don't think is correct. Like, I don't think it's 30 years, but like, there are these correlations to having these traumatic events as children to having negative experiences as adults. They're more likely to be alcoholics, have addiction, all these medical, like physical changes within your body, down to the DNA that is changed. So she gave this great TED Talk, and that was a few years ago, and that has exploded across the internet, that it's become so commonplace now. Some schools are giving ACE screeners, which is not how it's supposed to be used. So that is where we have to be careful, because I've seen a lot of speech pathologists go to trainings that they're being trained to give ACEs, ACE screeners. We are not trauma detectives. We are not there to say, oh, this child had this trauma at this age. Even the screeners that are given by pediatricians are de-identified. So it's like, give me the number that's here. The parents just give them a number. Oh, they've experienced three of these traumas at some point. They don't need to give them answers. It actually, what they saw was that parents were more likely to respond when it was de-identified rather than, yes, they were this at this age. They had this happen to them at this age. So that allows pediatricians to be mindful of what they need to do for healing. And what they found with the ACEs study was that the biggest thing to help these children was one safe person, one positive connection with an adult that was helpful for them. So that's our job. I like to think of that as our job as speech pathologists. We are going to be that one positive relationship as an adult. So a lot of times my role as a speech pathologist in the high school is not a disciplinarian. A lot of the time when they come in, I speak to them. I'm like, well, I see you got a detention. Like, I'm not mad or anything. Like, let's just talk about it. Tell me the situation and we talk about it. I'm not there to be a parent. I'm not there to come down on them at all. I want to know what was happening with them. And especially as the speech pathologist, I can kind of say, well, I work on a lot of this pragmatic stuff, is like, oh, did you have an argument with a student, and how could we better use that? So I can use these lessons as speech lessons, because I know all the time people are like, how do you bill for that? I'm like, I'm building relationships here, but I'm also covering my butt that we can make it part of the pragmatic session. We can make it part of comprehension. I can make whatever we're talking about fit into any arena that I want it to. But all in all, we are not there to decide that, oh, this student went through this trauma, or figure out that this student went through this trauma. I like to look at it, when I look through at the school, we have a database that people can send referrals for behavior, for anything. And a lot of the times you'll see like therapists comment. If I see anything about a student that is in need of help, that's where the collaboration comes in, that I'm like, okay, I need to refer this student to the therapist at our school. We have a wellness center. We have a wellness center on campus. And that is unique to our school, which we are very lucky to have, that we were given therapists from the district to come in for our students in crisis. So we have a building on campus that they can go to in times of crisis, and that's not available. So not available to other schools. So we're very lucky there. But again, my job for the collaboration part, I make sure that I refer out to, hey, this student needs to talk to a therapist. I'm not a therapist. I can do my best within the speech guidelines, but I cannot offer them therapy. So I need to know that this is able to go to someone else who can better handle it. I want them to handle this student with such care, and they can better do that than I can. So that's where the collaboration part comes into effect.
Awesome. All right. So did you have any more thoughts on like how trauma-informed care can be applied in the medical setting?
Yes. So I keep saying you need to use trauma-informed care with your coworkers, with yourself, with your patients, with yourself first. So a lot of times if I were acting poorly in any way, in my personal life, if I'm just like not able to answer texts or anything, I really am able to self-reflect and be like, am I not responding because of this reason, or am I really overwhelmed right now? And when I'm able to do that, I'm able to say, hey, I can't really talk right now, having a hard time, or I don't include that. You know, I just need to know. It's more about understanding my own self. Or if I'm quick to have a reaction to something, I notice that after the trauma, I've been diagnosed with PTSD. So that's one of the reasons my Instagram is ptsd.slp, because it's my own trauma and that of my students. So I can reflect on myself and be like, well, I'm really quick to anger, especially with adults. I've had a very hard time during like COVID and the pandemic when I see people not doing things that I think they should be doing. I get very angry. So I need to use my coping strategies in that moment. And I need to be able to just say, hey, you're kind of having a trauma response here. You got to bring that down and use your coping strategies. You can use it in the medical setting for your coworkers. Like I was talking about the nurse. In the school setting, we hear all the time kids labeled bad kids. Well, I know from trauma-informed therapy, they're not bad kids. There are no bad kids. They're having reactions to something. I know we talk all the time in schools about we can diagnose a kid with ADHD from far away. Like we know that kid. But you know, those ADHD symptoms are the exact same as PTSD. So what you might think from your professional standpoint is ADHD actually could be PTSD. So I like to look at my kids now. I'm like, maybe they're not ADHD, they're PTSD. And you have to do the same with your patients and your coworkers in the medical setting. So when we talk about that bad nurse, they're not a bad nurse. We do have bad nurses, but like they're not bad because they're not having a conversation or not being nice to us when they speak. They might not have the bandwidth to deal with that right now. They might have 2 seconds of time because they're so overwhelmed. We talk about our profession being so overwhelmed with our duties and everything, especially with productivity levels in the medical setting. We need to have that same reflection for our coworkers. With our patients, we need to know that some of these diagnoses, can, like the ADHD and PTSD thing, we need to know that these patients that we're having might have different life experiences than us, and things that we say can affect them. So I'm very careful to talk about things with my patients. I know I had a lot of veterans at one point when I was in grad school. There were a lot of veterans that I was talking to. And you know, a lot of the time, they don't want to talk about Vietnam. They don't want to talk about the war. They just want to see a 20-something year old girl that's like paying attention to them for 2 seconds. And they want to talk about shows. So you really have to build a relationship with these patients, these people that you are caring for. You need to know what the boundaries are with conversation. You can't just jump in because you want to talk about something. So I always let my patients decide where we're going with conversation. If they want to ask me questions, I'll show them where the boundaries are in that way. But it's about having that trust. All those principles of trauma-informed care that I use at the school level are used in the medical setting. And they're probably even more important in the medical setting because those are so scary. You know, some of the medical procedures that you're having are so scary, and they need someone to trust and they look to you for that. So it's really, really hard. But by implementing a trauma-informed way of care, you're making your sessions better, and you're also developing a bond with these patients that I think you will end up not going back to how you were treating people before. I think it's just, it's so important to have this type of way and use it in your personal life. I probably use it more in my personal life when people are acting out and I'm like, oh, they're being so mean today. And I'm like, all right, they're probably having a stressful time. It's COVID. Like, everyone needs to be given the benefit of the doubt. So that is my spiel for the medical setting.
That's awesome. Thank you, Rachel. This was really great. I really appreciate you coming on and opening my eyes to trauma-informed care and how that looks in the school system right now and in your own practice, and then how that can be applied to other settings and how I do elements of it, but how I can be a lot more conscious of it and intentional with it. So I really like that. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
So if people want to continue this conversation with you, learn more about it, where can they get in touch with you?
So on Instagram, I am at ptsd.slp. So it should say the PTSD SLP. I've had that account for about 2 years now, and it's kind of like a support group, but also I share resources of treating PTSD or trauma kids using trauma-informed care for myself, and just a sounding board for people to ask questions. So it's a really great space. And then on Facebook, this is more of just like a group for questions. It's PTSD resources for SLPs. A lot of people will post, hey, I have this student that is exhibiting these behaviors and I'm not really sure what to do. There's a lot of people on there that are trauma-informed or wanting to know about trauma-informed education. And they post, there's some experts in there, which is awesome. They'll tend to comment. So there's a lot of resources out there. I really recommend also getting trained in trauma-informed, or if there's any trainings available. I know a lot of the schools are doing it, but the medical settings are doing this a lot, I've heard, after COVID or with COVID, that a lot of them are like, we need to implement this. So keep a lookout for it and ask your like rehab managers or anywhere you work, hey, are these trainings available for us? I think that would be a great thing to advocate for.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Rachel. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
Thanks for listening to the Speech Uncensored podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes on speechuncensored.com and post a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts so other SLPs can find the podcast and join us on this journey. I want to give a big thanks to my brilliant audio editor, Laura Miller, for her amazing editing skills. And I'm so glad that you've decided to spend some of your time with us. And I hope the material that we've covered today has nourished your mind so that your practice can flourish. I hope you go out there and be awesome.